Hello, and welcome to the AK-47 podcast. My name is Kristen Godsey, and today I am doing a special bonus episode with the author of a new book, which has just come out with Oxford University Press. It just came out in February. It's called Socialism, A Logical Introduction. And so the reason that I think it's so interesting to talk about this book on this podcast is because this is a book that actually makes arguments for socialism and somewhat against capitalism. And this is a book that really believes in the power of arguments, of sort of rational discussion. And although Kollontai wrote a lot of different sorts of things, including fiction, as you know, if you've been listening to this podcast for as long as it takes you to get to this episode, you know that she wrote pamphlets and she wrote all sorts of documents and articles and books and fiction and autobiographies. She was a very prolific writer. But one of the things that I think Kollontai did very well, as best exemplified, I think, by the workers' opposition, is she took stands. She had moral commitments, and she believed in what you might call objective moral truths about the supremacy of the socialist way of being and living and socialist economy over capitalism. And instead of just sort of using emotion to promote her ideas, which she certainly did when she spoke, but she also had certain kinds of arguments that she backed up with evidence. And nowhere is this more apparent than in her very first book about maternity, where she traveled all around Europe and she looked at all the different policies that different European countries had implemented in order to support working women who also happened to be mothers. And in that book, and in the sort of subsequent documents that come out of that book, she basically takes all the evidence that she amassed and she makes a certain kind of platform. She makes a series of recommendations based on what she believes is the best evidence possible. And so this book, which, as I said, has just come out, it's like hot off the press, is a book that will allow you to make arguments about socialism. And I think it's really important that we do this because we're in kind of a precarious political moment globally with the rise of really, frankly, right-wing fascists, not only in the United States. Obviously, it looks like Trump might win the next presidential election, but also across Europe and across the globe. There are people who are using emotion, who are preying upon fear and anxiety in order to get people to vote against their economic interests. And so now more than ever, it's important to actually have a conversation about why socialism is a better economic and political system for us. So, welcome to the podcast, Professor Scott Sion.
Thank you for having me.
By way of introduction, Scott and I wrote an article for Eon, I don't know when that was, like 2018?
I think so.
So 2018, called Anti-Communism. I will link to that article in the show notes. And one of the things that's really interesting about that article is I'm talking about sort of the history of socialism, addressing nostalgia. And Scott was dealing with arguments. And I think it was the experience, right, of writing that article in some ways that led you to think about putting together a larger book. So can you give me a little bit of a history about what made you want to write this book?
That's basically right. We started with that article and we thought that there would be a good ground for having having a book about arguments in this way and arguments for and against socialism. That article was shared thousands of times.
And translated into lots of different languages.
And people seemed to be ready for that sort of treatment, the sort of philosophical treatment that was part of it. Your more distinct contribution was on the ethnographic side. And so the thought initially was that we would co-author a book, but it ended up just drifting away from that. It was hard enough to combine the anthropological and ethnographic perspectives along with the philosophical treatment of arguments in a short article. It was pretty clear pretty early on that that was going to be very hard to do for the course of a book. So I ended up just writing the book on my own.
Yeah. And can you give us a little sense about what it means for listeners who don't quite understand what a logical introduction means? What does it mean to write a book about arguments? Because I think, you know, Kollontai makes arguments, but she doesn't quite do it in the way that you do it with numbered steps and understanding what intermediate premises are and all these sort of formal things. So can you walk listeners through what that actually means in practice?
Sure. Yeah, so if you believe something, whether it is the doctrine of socialism or capitalism or the right to choose or that Trump is an idiot or anything that you believe, you presumably have reasons for that belief. You don't just wake up one morning and say, ah, I see that socialism is true. Sometimes changes in belief can seem kind of revelatory that way, but presumably there are reasons behind that recognition of the truth of socialism or whatever. And especially if you want to convince somebody else of your view, you ought to have reasons. Why would they believe you if you don't have reasons? You want to have an argument. So what is it to have reasons? What is it to have an argument? An argument starts with premises, some things that you assume to be true for the sake of that argument, and then it proceeds to conclusions that logically follow from the premises.
Okay, I need an example here because I don't think everybody's following you.
Well, you could have, you know, a very silly argument just in terms of, you know, having one two premises that lead to a conclusion. If the moon is made of green cheese, then Trump is the Messiah. Premise two, the moon is made of green cheese. Conclusion, Trump is the Messiah. That is what we call in philosophy a valid argument. The conclusion does logically follow from the premises, but the premises are not true. So it's not what we call a sound argument. But what we do in philosophy is, or often do, is to be quite explicit about our arguments in that way. And one technique that we have is to do what I just did then, is to break down the argument into explicit steps where the premises are noted. And then the conclusions, it's noted what they are said to follow from earlier in the argument. And this can be an enormously useful tool. It can help you to understand and clarify your own reasons for believing something, and it can cut mercilessly through the pretensions of a bad argument. The numbered step version of the argument, it's like the framework of your reasoning or the skeleton of your reasoning. And just as you would have a difficult time standing if your femurs were both broken, your reasoning will have a difficult time standing if you don't have good arguments, if you don't have arguments that are valid but also have true premises. So we like to do this in philosophy, break down the argument, figure out exactly what it is. It's far from trivial to be able to do that. The premises can be difficult to identify the premises of your own reasoning. It can be difficult to see what logically follows from what. Often we just get lazy. We accept things without real analysis of our reasons. A.E. Hausman once said that a moment's thought would have shown him, but a moment is a long time, and thought is a painful process. Now, for my part, I don't find analyzing arguments in this way painful at all. I do it for fun. But it is difficult, and not everybody has fun doing it. So what I've done in the book is to help you out. I analyze reasons for and against socialism and help you sort out the good arguments from the bad. I do side with socialism. That's where I think an honest analysis of the arguments lead. And if you're a committed socialist, you'll have the reason to read the book, because then you'll better understand the reasons for socialism. But you'll also, I think, better understand why it is that there are people who oppose it. And they're not always evil and immoral or stupid. They do have reasons. They do have arguments. In the end, I don't think the arguments work. And I think that there is important analysis to be done to show why they don't work. But I think we will be more likely to achieve the political goals that we want if we at least understand the opposing side and understand our own reasons better. And that's what I'm attempting to do in the book.
Yeah, because I think that a lot of people who are advocates for socialism, sometimes they believe things without really interrogating what it is that they believe. So I think a lot of people are like, well, everybody that I know thinks socialism is better than capitalism, or everybody that I know thinks capitalism sucks, so therefore socialism must be better. And, you know, it's easy to go along with a consensus. If everybody, you know, all of your friends are socialists, then it's easy to be a socialist. But I don't think that that was the kind of reasoning that people like Kollontai certainly used. They actually had sort of concrete beliefs about the way the economy might work when workers own the means of production, the way that central planning might work more efficiently. But you're not talking about those kinds of specific policy things, right? You're really talking about sort of a master argument in favor of socialism. Can you walk us through what that actually kind of looks like?
My overarching argument is just that socialism, first step, socialism will better promote human well-being than capitalism. Second step, socialism doesn't violate moral rights of individuals. The third step is a general moral premise that if one system better promotes human well-being and doesn't violate rights, then we should adopt it. It follows from those three premises that we should adopt socialism. Of course, a capitalist could run a parallel argument, making the other claims that capitalism promotes human well-being better than socialism and that capitalism doesn't violate rights. And of course, then that's just the start. Having set up the framework, the skeleton of our reasoning and the master argument for socialism, or comparing it with this argument for capitalism, then we need to look at the premises. We need to look at the truth of, is it true that socialism better promotes human well-being? Capitalists often claim the opposite. They also claim that socialism violates rights. But I have chapters in the book dealing with both of those claims and saying that they are wrong about those things, and that this master argument for socialism, as I call it, holds up, that in the end, it's sound, and we should move in the direction of socialism.
Right. And so in order to support the truth of the premises here, you're actually also dealing with empirical evidence. Yeah. So can you talk a little bit about the empirical evidence? Because I think that's where you're definitely closer to Kollontai, right? She's always looking for empirical evidence to support her claims. So what are the kinds of things that you're looking at in order to support the idea that socialism promotes human well-being?
Right. I'll just mention first that the second argument, that it doesn't violate rights, is more of a purely philosophical moral claim.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, to support the first premise that socialism better promotes human well-being, that is empirical. One needs to look at the evidence. The evidence can come in various different forms. One way you could do it is look at countries that are more socialist and look at countries that are less socialist and see how people are doing in those countries, how well-being is distributed. And you can also look at countries, because one of the aspects of socialism, as opposed to capitalism, is that there is more egalitarian distribution of resources. The Marx slogan was, from each according to ability to each according to need. Socialists need not go that far, you might say, but we want a lot more egalitarian distribution of resources than we have under current versions of capitalism. And there's a lot of evidence about that, that inequality is toxic, that gross levels of inequality lead to all kinds of bad health outcomes and just unhappiness and misery, and that we will be better off. And it's not surprising that inequality does that, and that moving towards equality would help, because money has diminishing marginal utility. If you give a homeless person $1,000, that will mean a whole lot more to them than if you give Elon Musk another $1,000.
Right.
He won't notice. And so that sort of general reason pulls in the direction of saying, yes, we should make things more equal. And so I explore a lot of the evidence of that sort, looking at some of the countries and the comparisons and some of the data on inequality. And then I also consider the capitalist arguments that, no, that's not going to work, that we need capitalist markets and we need even to allow extreme levels of inequality of wealth in order to make things better off for all of us. That's what they claim. And it's worth looking at their arguments for that rather than simply dismissing them.
Right. Simply dismissing them as sort of greedy or uneducated or whatever, Neanderthals or something
right.
like that. Yeah. I mean, because what you're trying to do with this book, I think, which is important, is to sort of get away from what are called ad hominem attacks or the emotional kind of responses that we get in a lot of contemporary politics, right? And yet the Hausman quote is really good. Like, thinking is hard. Arguing is hard. And what do you suggest if you're dealing with like your crazy uncle at Thanksgiving or some relative of yours who's just a irrational capitalist flunky, and brings it all back down to socialism just violates rights because of liberty and blah, blah, blah. And how do you use the tools of reason against people who are unreasonable?
That's difficult. I mean, and the venue and the particular situation might make it might be relevant if you really do just have your crazy uncle and it's Thanksgiving and he's already had six drinks. You know, you're probably not going to make much progress. It's probably not worth it.
Right.
But when you're having more calm discussions, which it is worth having with these people, I think one can make progress. And it helps to understand something about where they're coming from, why they have reasons for thinking that socialism is bad. And sometimes their reasons just depend on a misunderstanding, or they depend on, you know, even a logical fallacy at some time, or that their premises imply a lot more than they want them to imply. One of the ways that we put that sometimes in philosophy is we say that an argument or a premise proves too much. That is to say, it proves more than you want it to. One sort of traditional example of that, or an example in this debate that one sees a lot, is that you'll see conservatives of various sorts essentially promoting the idea that taxation is theft, that if you take taxes from one person to redistribute and give them to somebody else, that's just stealing. We wouldn't allow private people to do that. It's no different if the government does that.
Mm-hmm.
That's the argument they make. But, and it's not an utterly crazy argument, the distinction between what we allow private people to do and what we allow the government to do and the justification for that. That's a tricky business. And in some ways, that's the fundamental question of political philosophy, is the legitimate authority of the state and how we ground that, how we understand that. So it's not crazy.
Mm-hmm.
But when they assume that taxation is theft when it's done for the sake of redistribution, the part that seems to make it like theft, that one person's taking from another person without their permission and under coercive threat, that would imply that any taxation whatsoever is theft. And that would push you into an extreme form of anarchism, where we don't have a military, we don't have courts, we don't have anything, because all of that requires taxation. So that's one of these cases where some conservatives use arguments, usually just sort of quick, like meme sorts of arguments, but where the premises imply a whole lot more than they want them to imply. And once that's pointed out, what reaction you'll get might depend on the conservative. Hopefully, they'll stop and think about it. Sometimes they'll just think, well, I don't want to push it that far. But premises aren't like that. They're not like buses in the city that you can take as far as you want and then get off. Their premises imply whatever they imply. And if they have premises that imply absurd conclusions, their premises are false.
Right. And so who, in your mind, is the ideal target audience for this book? Because I think, you know, as you said, you started by saying for socialists, this is really good because it kind of will give you some ammunition to argue your case for socialism. But it also seems on some level that there's an implicit audience here of people on the other side who want to engage in arguments and that you might be able to sway, right?
Yes. And I think it is certainly both. I think it's good for socialists to understand the grounds for their own beliefs. I also might have some surprises for some people who are on this side, because I don't accept all of the arguments that some people do give for socialism. Some of them I think are stronger than others, and I think that's a reasonable thing to do, to note. Not everything that's in favor of your position, just because it supports what you want to believe, doesn't make it true.
Right. And you actually got like a libertarian, right? Jason Brennan to blurb your book. I mean, that's right. Pretty impressive.
That is true. Yeah. He says that readers can easily see what's at stake given the way that I present the arguments, and that this book will serve as a valuable means of allowing good faith people of all sides to talk to each other rather than past each other. It was a wonderful blurb from a libertarian that I didn't know before. I just asked him out of the blue if he would be interested in looking at the book and perhaps endorsing it. Getting back to your question is about people on the other side and the primary audience. I would hope that there are a number of groups of people. There are some where at least they'll understand that socialism is not crazy and that it's not favoring totalitarian regimes like the Soviet bloc, and that there are good reasons for it. That will at least raise the level of intelligence of the discourse about this. I do have kind of specific hopes for what I tend to think of as usually young people who are more likely to be able to switch. And I think in some cases, it's the libertarians on the right that tend to be more interested in argument. They think that they're the ones that are being reasonable and that these lefties only deal with their emotions. They, you know, facts don't care about your feelings,
right,
that sort of thing.
Sort of woke dogma, yeah.
And those people, insofar as they're sincere about that, their devotion to reason and to actually paying attention to facts and arguments, they might actually be swayed. I think we can flip some of them.
So this is very much a political project as much as it is an intellectual project.
Yes.
Yeah, once again, very much in the vein of Kollontai's sort of more persuasive writing. So we have yet another offer for listeners to the podcast. It looks like Professor Sion has about 10 author's copies that he is willing, is that correct? Willing to send to you for free.
That's right. Subject to one condition, that you actually promise to read it.
Yes, the implicit premise, right, that you will read the book. So if you are interested in receiving a copy of Socialism, a Logical Introduction, just out with Oxford University Press, this offer is available once again for listeners in the United States. I really apologize to my international listeners, but postage is much more expensive internationally than it is within the United States, where we can send books media mail. So if you are interested in receiving a copy of this book, please send your name and address, again, within the United States, to Alexandra Kollontai Podcast at gmail.com. So that's alexandra.kollontai.podcast@gmail.com. And Professor Sion will pop one of these books in the mail to you, and you can learn how to argue in favor of socialism and against capitalism. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you very much for having me.
And as always, thank you all so much for listening. Today, we have a very special outro because Scott has agreed to let me sample a little bit of his rendition of Woody Guthrie's classic song, This Land Is Your Land, but with a special verse that often doesn't get played. So please enjoy this sample of Scott's version of This Land Is Your Land and keep up the good fight.
In the squares of the city, in the shadow of the steeple, near the relief office, I see my people, and some are grumbling, and some are wondering, if this land's still made for you and me. Big high wall there, you tried to stop me. Sign was painted, said private property. But on the backside, you didn't say nothing. Now that side was made for you and me. This land is your land, this land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made.